WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. World chess champion Garry Kasparov bolstered the human ego when he triumphed earlier this year in a match with Deep Blue, an IBM computer. Kasparov became the Soviet chess champion at age 18. In 1985, at the age of 22, he defeated Anatoly Karpov to become the youngest world champion in history. Kasparov grew up in the Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan. The Soviet authorities considered his success to be great PR until he became an outspoken critic of communism. He's now active in Russia's political life and campaigned for Russian President Yeltsin's re-election. Now he has a new talking chess game called Talking Coach, which is designed to be both a coach and a worthy opponent. I asked him about his match against the computer Deep Blue. What was the computer's approach to analyzing the game?
Deep Blue was never designed as a chess computer. In fact, Deep Blue emerged from IBM research of parallel processors. And they recognized by mid-80s, probably late-80s, that chess could give them unique opportunity to try to solve this very important problem in the computing industry, which is to force parallel processors talk to each other without wasting a lot of energy by just doubling the same results. Deep Blue's way of playing, Deep Blue's style, if you call it, it's quite simple and primitive. You know, it calculates, calculates, and calculates. It's a brute force of calculation. But we faced, in fact, I had to face in last February, a phenomenon when quantity was translated into a real quality jump, because suddenly we discovered that on these numbers, ads, and Deep Blue could make per average 100 million positions per second, which is a big number, even for the beginners, for chess fans, or for just for the general public and for professional players. With these numbers, I realized that Deep Blue was able to solve some positional problems because it saw so deep and it could avoid some short-term positional mistakes. I'm not talking, of course, about tactics. You know, it's so sharp and so precise. Now they are working very hard to get some chess knowledge into the machine to make this machine fit for a real chess challenge. And in fact, we'll face very soon a super powerful version of Deep Blue. And next May, when I play it again, it will not be easy at all.
Now, how does computer logic differ from human logic in playing chess?
I think the biggest difference between human player and computer is flexibility. Because when we play chess, we cannot calculate everything to the very end. We have to make selection of the move based on some very subjective factors. We have to evaluate the position. We have to look 3, 4, 5 moves ahead as far as we can and to find out from our perspectives what could be the net result of different route we're going to take. There are many, many factors that we have to take into account. But I know, and all my human opponents, they know that these factors, even some of them are dominant, in many positions can lose their importance. That's why we can easily reshuffle these factors, these priorities, and we are evaluating position using our intuition rather than a pure mathematical calculation. Now, when computer is doing the same exercise and it just it calculates a line and it goes to the end of the line and has to evaluate the final position, computer has a set of priorities built up by the programmers. And this is a fixed set of priorities. That's important to understand. It's if number one priority is a pawn structure, number two is the position of the king, I mean safety of the king, it will always be number one and number two, even if these factors are less important in the very special position that could arise in the middle of the complicated line. That's why computer is not able to reshuffle these priorities. And the moment you realize the way machine thinks, the way machine makes decisions, machine is very vulnerable to your strategy, because I can change my strategy. I can shift from one strategic route to another. Machine is not capable of doing so. Also, during the match, the six games match, programmers, they don't have any time to change these priorities. That's why it will take them 2, 3, 4, 5 months in the lab when they can learn the lessons of the previous match and then to change the machine to set up new priorities. But, you know, at the end of the day, the flexibility is a big, big problem for the machine.
So do you feel that you were able to analyze the computer's thinking and then outsmart it?
Yes, I was very lucky that the first two games, you know, I lost game one and I won game two. It meant the first two games ended with an even score. And these two games gave me invaluable information about the way machine was operating. And at the end of game two, I knew more or less correctly what was the general approach of the machine. And that's why I was able to build my strategy based on these assumptions. And at the end of the match, it was proven that my assumptions were absolutely correct. I felt at what point Deep Blue would be very stubborn and it would not be able to shift from one route to another.
Did you feel like you were representing mankind against machine, and that if you lost, it would be a defeat for mankind, and if you won, a triumph for the human being?
I don't think we can talk about the triumph, because the machines are getting better and better. That's why even if,
right,
if
the battle's not over yet.
Yeah, exactly. If it's a triumph, it's very temporarily. But the defeat could be quite disastrous, and that's why the pressure on my shoulders, the psychological pressure was much higher than a normal chess event, because when I play a world championship match, I can lose my title, which is important for myself. It's important for my relatives, my friends, some time is important for chess, but playing machine, I represented a very, very, I wouldn't say the whole mankind, but definitely many, many people that believe that human's integrity and human superiority was in danger.
Okay, so here you have all the psychological pressure on you, even more pressure than when you're defending your title against another person, and yet you can't psych out a machine in the way you can psych out an opponent. You can't look at the machine and expect to intimidate them with your look. You can't analyze the computer's face and see where are their vulnerabilities today.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, any outside psychological factors working against me, because machine doesn't tire, machine doesn't care about the weather, about the noisy public, about the press, you know, about just any other factor will work against me, because I'm a human being and I'm exposed to some disturbances during the event. But as I said already, machine is not flexible. And again, the moment I know the characteristics of my opponent, I feel very comfortable, very confident, because I know this opponent now, it's like an open book for me. When I have a human opponent, I will never enjoy the same privilege. The question is whether I will be able in next May to do the same within the first two games. I mean, just to get all information from these games, to analyze that, and to make a new portrait of my opponent. Because the disadvantage of the first match and also the second one, that I do not have access to any game played by Deep Blue. That's why, you know, I have to prepare myself for the opponent without any available information.
Is it ever frustrating to play against a computer that doesn't sweat and it doesn't show any kind of crack emotionally? And if you're frustrated, I mean, what are you going to do? You're just staring at this implacable object.
No, if I'm frustrated, I will lose. You know,
right. Is that true? Frustration and it's all over?
Frustration is the first step, because under this pressure, you can't afford to be frustrated. It just you lose control for a second. And with a human being, you can hope for opponent's mistake.
Right.
It could be a gesture of goodwill. In fact, the opponent also could crack under pressure. If we you do a mistake with a machine, there's no mercy. That's why the difference between a game against a machine is that you can lose your concentration. And the moment you're frustrated, your concentration will be lost for sure.
Now, what do you do in a chess match to keep up your concentration and to prevent frustration or any other emotion from interfering with your game?
No, it's absolutely impossible to keep frustration out of you for the whole match. I do my best, but even in a match against Deep Blue, I was frustrated a couple of times. And in game four, for instance, when I was a crack in the computer and just it didn't work for about 15 minutes and just they lost the signal and whatsoever. And I was very nervous. It's obvious frustration. And then I immediately made one mistake, another mistake, and I was very, very close losing again. Luckily, my position was quite good before it happened. That's why I was able to defend that. But it was very, very unpleasant. And I felt pretty bad. And I mean, I learned that whatsoever, I have to keep my concentration and just ignore what's going around. I think it's doable, yes, to be quiet. If you can concentrate on your opponent, you know, I try to imagine that it's an opponent with some qualities. You know, it could be human being, it could be a machine, but it's just an opponent. And this opponent has such and such and such characteristics. And as I have to take this or that strategic route to play the game because that will be the best and the most annoying for my opponent. And trying to isolate myself from the nature, physical nature of the opponent, that helps.
Garry Kasparov is my guest, world chess champion. Let's take a short break and then I'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with world chess champion Garry Kasparov. And now he has a new chess game that's called Talking Coach, and it's a computerized chess game that actually gives you advice as you play. Now, how did you learn to play?
I was watching my parents playing and or trying to solve a problem, and I was very curious about this mysterious game, and I learned from my father at age 5 and a half.
Your father died when you were 7.
Yeah.
How did that change your life as a young boy and also as someone who is interested in chess?
I can hardly recall any memories of that time.
Mm-hmm.
It was over a quarter century ago.
Right.
And I didn't memorize well my relationship with my father because as a child, you're not concentrating very much on something that always was you. And you know, these relations, it was just a part of my normal life, and suddenly he's gone. And I mean, I was very lucky to have a mother that spent whole of her life just working for my success. And that's why, you know, it was probably a bit one-sided because I didn't have a father, but my mother created an atmosphere where I could grow as a proper person.
So she already loved the game and played it well?
No, she was a very random player, but she knew that I had a talent, and she did everything to help me to grow as a chess player and also to be a well-educated person.
What did you like about chess as a child?
I think as a child, I loved playing chess. I was winning very often, and that's also a good factor. But it's a strange relation that I can hardly describe. I felt very good playing chess. I felt that it's something that is built for me, or I'm built for that. And at very early age, 13 to 14, I knew it would be my profession and I could be very, very successful, even to be a potential world champion.
Now, when you were young and you were starting to beat adults, how did they react?
Some of them didn't react friendly because I was very young to beat the adults. And today, it's a quite normal when you see 12 or 13 years old kid beating, you know, an adult player. But at the time when I started playing chess, it was quite unusual. And I can recall certain moments when they expressed openly their frustration by losing to a kid. But, you know, it went away very soon because I got my reputation. And in fact, the playing adults moved me to adult world too early. And that's probably one of the regrets that I have about my childhood, because I had to stay in a different atmosphere and some of the joys of childhood were lost.
Is there an age that's considered to be the prime for a chess player?
50 years ago, you know, 40 years ago, the conventional wisdom was that 35 to 40 years, that's a prime time for the chess player. Today, it sounds very funny because most of the top chess players are under 30. And I think it's absolutely normal because we have a new type of the game. It's a professional game. It takes more time. You have to study a lot. And it's just, you don't pay enough attention, you'll be out of the loop. And also, it requires too much energy. And the pressure on the players is bigger than before. And that explains why younger players are so successful.
How important and how popular was chess in the Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan, where you grew up?
Well, chess was a very important part of the Soviet Union, all parts of the Soviet Union. I think there were a few reasons. Maybe it has to do something with the culture, but the main reason was that the Soviet regime always treated chess as a super important ideological weapon to prove the superiority of the Soviet communist regime over decadent West. And that's why chess from late 20s in the Soviet Union, chess was seen by party officials as an important game, and they always paid a great deal of attention. That's why the chess players, they got state support, and by playing chess on a good level, by playing chess for national team, you could make a decent living and you could get certain independence from the Communist Party. And I think that's because of the reason I just described, many parents considered chess, other sports, music, ballet, as one of the few opportunities that they were open for their kids. And that's why chess, among other things I described, was very popular. And I don't think that the number of talented kids in United States or in France is lower than in Russia. But there are too many other options for kids in the Western countries, and chess was not a prestigious one. That's why the Soviet Union exploited maximum of its chess potential, while other countries never had the same attitude toward the game.
When did you realize that if you got really good at chess, that the Soviet Union would use you as an ideological weapon in this Cold War?
Yeah, but I was very happy about that because I wanted to be the world champion. You know, I was not a big hero, you know, fighting for the human rights. I had a very modest goal for a big ideological war, but for myself it was crucial. You know, I wanted to be number one in the world. I felt I had a good chance, and I realized very soon that in order to avoid troubles that I had in the Soviet Union, because I'm not an ethnic Russian, and I had to fight Anatoly Karpov, who was an ethnic Russian and a darling of the system, I had to be loyal to the communist regime. I mean, just without making too much noise. In fact, I couldn't avoid making noise because I'm quite rebellious by my nature. But still, I was trying very hard, and before 85, I behaved myself. I couldn't avoid all the troubles, but only after I won the title, I was able to demonstrate my independence very openly.
So you think that the Soviet government preferred the person who you got the title from, Karpov, because he was an ethnic Russian and you were not, you were Azerbaijani?
No, I'm half Armenian and half Jewish.
Half Armenian, half Jewish,
which is probably not a very good thing as well for Russia. But
absolutely.
No, I think it's, you know, the ethnical factor was important, but more important was that I never, you know, I couldn't show that the real ties with the regime. You know, they felt that I'm not a very disciplined member of the community, and Karpov represented them very well because he was ready. And he indicated that at a young age, and he continued to play under the rules that they established. And I always tried to break the rules. And despite my hard attempts to be a good boy, they felt that it would be over as soon as I won the title.
What rules did you break?
Well, no, you have to respect the rules that everything happened in the Soviet Union was an internal matter. You couldn't go to foreign journalists. You couldn't make the stories a property of the rest of the world. And when they closed, my first match was Karpov in 85, you know, I made big statements, which were nothing more than, you know, complain about the injustice in chess. But I complained to the rest of the world, you know, that's not good. And the whole style of my lifestyle, my behavior, I mean, was very much against these very strict rules imposed on important personalities in the Soviet Union.
World chess champion Garry Kasparov. He now has a new talking chess game called Talking Coach. Kasparov will be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with world chess champion Garry Kasparov. He became the youngest world champion in 1985 at the age of 22. Earlier this year, in a grueling match, he defeated the IBM computer Deep Blue. Kasparov grew up in the Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan and now lives in Russia. You said before that you think one of the reasons why chess had been so important in the Soviet Union was because it was an ideological weapon in the Cold War. It was a way to prove, you know, the Soviet people are so smart and they're the best at chess. Now that the Cold War is over, do you think that chess will remain as important as it was in the past?
Oh, it's obviously losing its importance.
It is?
Yeah, because the government doesn't pay anymore. The Russian Chess Federation should live on its own. Also, chess is not a part of the IOC, International Olympic Committee, and that's why not represented. Chess is not represented on the big Olympic Games, and that's why it's in the eyes of the sport officials, it has less importance, because we have something, you know, separate events, and they're less prestigious than the big Olympics that just recently took place in Atlanta. And clearly the Russian chess is suffering a setback, but we had a very good tradition. We still have many young players, and Russia today is still the dominant and the strongest chess country in the world. But for the future, I have some worries because the number of the chess tournaments in Russia, it's less than it has to be for a country of such chess importance.
You're very active in Russian politics, and you worked actively.
I was.
What? Well, you worked actively for Yeltsin's re-election. Has something changed since then?
I was quite active in Russian politics, in the Soviet politics in the late 80s, early 90s, then in Russian politics in 93, now in 96. I didn't have any special political aspirations, but I believe that a person of my importance and, you know, the world champion in Russia is chess champion. It's more than just a simple world champion. It's kind of a symbol of the country. And I felt I couldn't be silent. I had to tell people about my views, my opinions, and that would help them to make their own choice. And I participated in the political life at the moments of the crucial importance, as at the moment of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and then this fight between President Yeltsin and the parliament. And, of course, I helped Mr. Yeltsin to be reelected, not because I supported very much Mr. Yeltsin's policies, but we had a very simple choice, either the current government or the communist comeback. And I believed, and I still believe, that if communists had a chance to take over Kremlin, that would be a disaster for the country. And I did my best traveling throughout the country, meeting people and telling them that we'd better stick with Mr. Yeltsin.
There's been a lot of speculation about your own political aspirations. Do you have any?
Not yet. I'm used to study carefully my chances in every field. And I knew, as I said, at age 13 or 14, I would be a potential world champion. It takes some time for me to understand what I want to accomplish in politics, if I want to move in, and what are my chances. And obviously now I'm occupied with chess, with other chess activities. We have greater chances to build a website, chess website with IBM. I'm working on many things related to chess. I have some business aspirations. And I decided just to put these political ideas aside for a while, and I will reevaluate these chances by the end of this century, because I still believe there are too many things I have to accomplish before I move to active politics, which prevents you from doing anything else.
What do you think of chess as a spectator sport?
I think it has some hidden potential. I think it's underestimated because chess always had a problem to find its box. You know, we couldn't even describe chess, whether it's a sport, and some countries deny that. In many countries, it's not recognized as a sport. It's kind of science or culture. And chess has too many factors. And now with internet, with these new technologies, networks, we have a very good chance of making chess a spectacular sport. We have a way to bring people into the interactive game and just then help them to follow the event through very sophisticated technologies. Also, within the last few years, we are practicing or experimenting with so-called speed chess. It's the game where every opponent has only 25 minutes to complete his moves. And that's a very good televised version of chess. And the speed chess circuit was very successful in some major cities.
Garry Kasparov, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
World chess champion Garry Kasparov has a new talking chess game called Talking Coach. This is Fresh Air.